15 have arrived. We'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We will start the meeting, however. I will move when we have a quorum. House File 3163, a Seltzer bill. If you could please join us, Representative Seltzer. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Before we get started, however, I will ask the question if there's anyone else other than Ms. Madden that would like to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns thereof.
Thank you. Right. Thank you.
Mr. Cummings, you want to join us down here? Or you be a resource? Okay. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Representative Seltzer, we do not officially have the bill before us, but let's pretend we did. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Davids and members of the committee, for hearing this bill to help our working families today. And as I'm out in the community, especially as I door knock in the more modest neighborhoods in my community and in the apartments, buildings, both single and married people with children just are expressing to me that they are worried financially, they're worried about the future, they're worried about debt. And so that's why I'm bringing forward this bill today to increase the working family credit in Minnesota. As you know, the working family credit is Minnesota's version of the earned income tax credit. It was first enacted in 1991. And the working family credit, as you also know, rewards work. And it helps working people meet basic needs and gets children off to a stronger start. And it can only be claimed, obviously, by people who are working. Nearly 340,000 households in Minnesota with modest incomes received the working family credit in 2013. And it is calculated based on a family's earning and family size. The average amount of a credit received in 2013 was $623. As you also probably know, low and moderate income Minnesota households on an average pay a larger share of their incomes in state and local taxes than higher income households. And so the working family credit helps offset those disparities. Families receiving the working family credit are evenly divided between Greater Minnesota and the Twin City metro area. 48% live in Greater Minnesota and 52% live in the seven county metro area. In total, 12.3% of all households who file income taxes received the working family credit in 2013. So why should we increase the working family credit? Longitudinal research on credits like this one has shown that these credits are successful in supporting parents' work efforts and provide long-lasting positive effects for children and families that receive them. These children are healthier, do better educationally, and earn more as adults. Because these credits are received once a year after a family files their taxes, many families use these credits to either build their savings or reduce debt. And we know that healthcare debt and student debt is soaring in Minnesota. There is a federal research paper that I would be happy to provide a link for committee members to that shows the research and gives more detail on how folks tend to use credits such as these. So the bill does increase the size and the reach of the working task force, working family credit. And I know that there are many different kinds of tax cuts being proposed this year, and I just think this is an important proposal to add to the mix. And with the chair's permission, Ms. Madden could go actually through the technical portions of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Seltzer. Please state your name and who you represent for the member, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. I really want to thank Representative Seltzer for bringing this bill forward, and also want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the good conversation we had yesterday on this issue. And I know many members of this committee have supported efforts around marriage penalty and other issues related to the working family credit over the years. So I'm glad to have this discussion again for this year. This bill does a number of changes to the calculations for the working family credit. So I know you have received the fiscal note and the technical details of that. Essentially, the bill does three things to expand the working family credit. First, it increases the size of the credit that many currently eligible households can receive. It increases the incomes that households can earn and still receive the credit, which makes some additional households eligible. Now, these income ceilings do vary depending on the number of children in the family and the marital status. But for example, a married couple with one child would be eligible for the credit under this bill with household income up to $47,580, but a married couple with two children with $53,440. And thirdly, it lowers the age requirement that currently applies under this credit just to workers who don't have dependent children. Under current law, these workers need to be at least 25 years old, and this bill would lower that age limit to 21. The bill also includes a federal conformity provision related to marriage penalties that has a fiscal impact starting in fiscal year 2019. So, you know, there may be some overlap with some of the bills you heard yesterday on that federal conformity provision. As a result of the combined changes in the law under this proposal, about 386,000 households would receive a tax reduction. That average reduction would be $125, and about 110,000 households would become eligible for the credit who are not eligible now. So you heard the governor's David's bill yesterday, that included some provisions related to the working family credit. The provisions in this bill related to families with children is very similar, although not identical to those provisions. And then the provisions in this bill for workers that do not have dependent children are really inspired by and modeled on some ideas being discussed at the federal level around the federal earned income tax credit. It's not often at the federal level that you see proposals come forward from House Speaker Ryan and President Obama, but there's a lot of interest on a bipartisan level of taking the positive pro-work impact that these credits have had on working parents and have the same kind of impact on workers without dependent children. So the portions in this bill that relate to workers without dependent children are really modeled after those federal proposals. But knowing that the wheels tend to move slowly up in Washington, D.C., we think it's really an area where Minnesota should just go ahead and move forward. I think this is an important proposal to bring forward, given the strong impact on working families, on families being able to support themselves and getting kids off to a better start. So I thank you for the opportunity to bring this to talk about this proposal today, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. I will officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order as we have a quorum. I will now move, Representative Simonson will move the minutes of March 22nd, 2016. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I just hope Representative Simonson is never absent because we just wouldn't work. Okay, so with that, Representative Earhart moves House File 3163, so it is before us. Ms. Mann, thank you for your testimony. I think we'll bring our resource person down. Please stay there because I will open up for questions from members here after we've had all the testimony. Again, has anybody else come into the room that wishes to testify in favor of this bill or with concerns? Okay, I do have one question. Maybe Mr. Cummings, before we get started. How does the Seltzer bill differ from what's sitting in conference committee? Are there big differences? The age thing, or what else do we have? Ms. Madden?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. The bills in conference have some different proposals related to the working family credit. It does not include significant expansions, such as you're discussing today. Last year's tax bill had provisions related to residency of households who received the working family credit.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Seltzer, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. The Minnesota Working Family Credit is a refundable credit for taxpayers who are eligible for the Federal Earned Income Credit. To qualify, the taxpayer must have income from wages or self-employment, and the income cannot exceed a maximum amount. Although the Minnesota Working Family Credit uses the same eligibility requirements and definitions of the Federal Earned Income Credit, the calculation of the state credit is separate. Currently, the credit and income threshold for taxpayers without children phases out at a very low level. Mr. Chair, Governor Mark Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith are working hard to build an economy that works for all Minnesotans. That's why Governor Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Smith proposed a $100 million investment to expand opportunities and eliminate disparities for Minnesotans all across our state. In addition, the governor proposed an increase to the Working Family Credit in a supplemental budget and is very supportive in strengthening the credit. The Working Family Credit is one of the most effective tools we have in fighting poverty, and we appreciate Representative Seltzer's bill to increase the credit. While the governor's approach did not include all of Representative Seltzer's changes, we are supportive of efforts to enhance the credit, and this bill strategically makes common sense choices to expand the credit. The Minnesota Budget Project has been on the forefront of researching the impact of the Working Family Credit and proposing modifications. The department would like to thank Ms. Madden and the Minnesota Budget Project for their leadership on this issue. This proposal increases the credit for 386,000 taxpayers, particularly those without children and more middle-class families. For those without children only, the minimum age to qualify for the credit would drop from 25 to 21. Mr. Chair, if this bill moves through the process, and as it does, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Seltzer, staff, and partners. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for any of the three, the author or the two witnesses? Okay, then, Representative Earhart renews his motion on House File 3163, and what we'll do is we'll lay it over. At this point, thank you, Ms. Madden. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Item next is Representative Quam here. Yes, he is. Okay. I will move House File 2972 to have it before us. Are there any amendments on that one? I don't think so. Okay, so we have the bill before us as is. Welcome, committee. Representative Quam, if you could please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And frankly, this bill has two reasons for it. One, there was a recent tax court ruling. Supreme Court overruled that ruling, but there was a minority report. Within that minority report, it stated that the legislature needs to clarify this issue. And it seems obvious there is some debate as to what this means from the legislative perspective to the courts, and they're interpreting it differently. And frankly, I think part of our responsibility as a legislature is to help out the other co-equal branch by having clarity on issues that they are perplexed at times about. So one point of this bill is to initiate the activity in the legislative branch to provide that clarity. The second point of this bill, and I had asked staff to generate it from the perspective of the minority report in the Supreme Court and the ruling of the tax judge, so that would bound that discussion between the minority interpretation and the majority interpretation, so that when we work to clarify for the courts, the co-equal branch, what we mean, the legislature defines it and prevents ambiguity. And so my intent is not to go, this is the perfect way to interpret it. It's to get that discussion going, and by having it bounded, limit that discussion, and so we can quickly come to a resolution and enlighten the courts as to what the legislative branch feels residency in respect to taxation should be. And I'm open to whatever this body decides to do. And I'm just here to help facilitate that discussion and hopefully clarity in statute.
Thank you, Mr. McQuam. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns thereof on House File 2972? Does the department wish to make some comments? Please join us. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to connect with Representative Quam last night, and looking forward to the conversation today. This bill would reverse the effect of the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision on Marks versus Commissioner of Revenue, issued on February 17, 2016. The court ruled that when determining residency for income tax purposes, all the days the taxpayer spent in Minnesota may be aggregated, including the days the taxpayer was domiciled in Minnesota. The bill excludes from the day count on days that a taxpayer was domiciled in Minnesota, so that a taxpayer who is in the state as a non-resident and in the state for part of the year as a resident can exclude from day count those days which the taxpayer was a resident. For the first time, the day count would have to start over when someone becomes a part-year resident. This would be challenging for the purposes of the residency statutes. Mr. Chair, let me be clear. This is now a settled area of law. It is an easy area of law for taxpayers to understand. It is an easy area of law for the department to administer. If this bill becomes law, the Department of Revenue and taxpayers would lose what is the clearest absolute law, rule of law concerning residency. If you are in the state for more than half the days of the year and maintain a home in Minnesota, you are going to be taxed as a resident of Minnesota. In its place, taxpayers in the department would be looking at domicile factors of a part-year resident, and often would be looking at those factors to try and pinpoint the exact date that a taxpayer changed domicile. Indeed, the bill would allow a taxpayer to be physically present in the state for 364 days and avoid being taxed as a full year resident by taking all actions necessary to become a Minnesota domiciliary 182 days into the calendar year. Taxpayers who spend a significant amount of time in our state and enjoy the benefits and protections of the state of Minnesota should share in the obligations associated with those benefits, Mr. Chair. A taxpayer who spends one half of the year or more in Minnesota benefits from many protections, benefits, and services that are paid for by the taxpayers in Minnesota and are treated as residents under current statute. Mr. Chair, let me read Adelin Luther versus Commissioner of Revenue from 1990. In 1990, Luther had the opportunity to enjoy the many services, benefits, and protections afforded her by Minnesota in her right to receive and enjoy her income. She used Minnesota roads and enjoyed police and fire protection. Her home was protected by these services all year long. On every day of the year, state laws protected her checking, savings, and investment accounts, as well as the corporations with which she affiliated. When Luther was in the state, she also benefited from Minnesota's high health and environmental standards, educational opportunities, arts and cultural opportunities, and state recreational resources, all of which are supported by state government. While the above list of services and protections are not exhaustive, this listing makes it clear that for the majority of 1990, and then it goes on to talk about that case. But I think it also just does say that there is some clarity about ensuring that there's fairness for people who are enjoying the benefits and protections. Whether it is the roads, parks, police protection, fire departments, or many other services that our state provides, if a taxpayer spends over half the year in Minnesota while maintaining an abode, they should qualify as a Minnesota resident. We believe that identifying the appropriate residency status of taxpayers is important for the integrity and administration of our tax system. We know this topic, this is a topic of a great deal of conversation, and we look forward to continuing that conversation with members. Mr. Chair, you have raised questions about residency in the past, and we thank you for the opportunity to sit down with you earlier this session. Based on discussions in the 2014 legislative session, the department initiated a review of the residency law, both the statute and the rule, and the department's application of them. The department conducted listening sessions between May and December of 2014. We held 6 listening sessions with over 100 participants to hear what tax, banking, insurance, and financial professionals think about Minnesota's residency law as it relates to the individual income taxes. We issued a report that includes information and feedback gathered during listening sessions all over the state, including the Minnesota Society of CPAs. We talked to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota State Bar Association, Minnesota Association of Public Accountants, Minnesota Bankers Association. As a result of the valuable information learned while creating this report, the department made several changes to our process for addressing domicile and residency. First, we revised our contact letters and requests for information. We simplified the format, reduced the amount of information we initially request, and included a set of common questions and answers taxpayers have about the process of residency audits. Second, we modified our questionnaire to collect information in a more efficient manner. We eliminated questions we can verify through other forms of research. Third, we modified our procedures and provided additional training to our employees to ensure we have a common, standard approach to requesting and reviewing information for residency audits. Mr. Chair, this focus on training was extensive and helped connect employees, whether they worked in the phone room or directly on residency audits, to have an improved common approach to work on these cases. And Mr. Chair, I was invited to a training that happened, and I went to the training and I spoke a little bit about the discussion that had been had at the legislature. And then the next week I was invited to another training, so I went down and I talked about what happened at the legislature. And then, Mr. Chair, on that third week, I was invited to another training.
And sounds I like you're well trained.
What was going on?
Highly trained.
And what we found out is that we wanted to ensure that whether that one time we were talking to people who may just be taking phone calls on our income tax line, we were talking to corporate tax attorneys who might have who might be asked questions. Corporate tax auditors who might have questions about it. Talk to people in our individual tax division. So the training was extensive and included anyone who might touch a residency audit or maybe even ask questions about it. Fourth, Mr. Chair, we revised our audit reports to more closely reflect the intent component of domicile. Fifth, we provided taxpayers and representatives with helpful tips for handling a residency audit. Sixth, we updated all website content and centralized it into a one-stop shop for residency information. Seventh, as we stated we would, Mr. Chair, we issued a revenue notice based on the current law and rule that clearly stated the following. Employing, hiring, or engaging an attorney or CPA or having a business relationship with an attorney or CPA in Minnesota does not by itself demonstrate an intent to establish or retain domicile. And having one or more bank accounts in Minnesota does not by itself demonstrate an intent to establish or retain domicile in Minnesota. In addition, we can't change the factors, but we can look at them from the modern world we live in. For instance, for factor R, Mr. Chair, the location of other transactions with financial institutions, we will look at the location where your transactions occur, the ATM walk-in where the loan application is completed, rather than the address of the bank on the bottom of the check. As I mentioned before, we believe that identifying the appropriate residency status of taxpayers is important for the integrity and administration of our tax system. As a person who resides in Minnesota and uses our services, it is only fair that others who primarily reside in Minnesota pay their fair share. The changes that I just outlined will help ensure that we have consistent, transparent, and fair treatment for all taxpayers. So, Mr. Chair, if this bill or other residency bills move through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, and others. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
Well, thank you. So, yeah, you have some concerns, and you are you are a resource on this bill.
Highly trained.
With that, but highly trained. I would say also that this bill is kind of an additional caveat, if you will, compared to the work we've been doing on some residency things. So, I think Representative Quam brings an important bill, some important ideas, but it's kind of a, I don't say separate necessarily, it has to do with residency, but it's kind of separate from what we've been working on to this point. So maybe, Mr. Michael, could you give us a little history as House Research would see it? And please say that. I think there might be some questions, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it might be helpful for the committee if I provide just a little bit of context in which this bill arises, so it's easier to sort of understand the issue. And the first thing to keep in mind is that there are two fundamental tests the way an individual can become a Minnesota resident for income tax purposes. The first is the old traditional domicile test that's been around since the tax was enacted back in 1933. And that test is an intent test, and it's basically what the common law said is if you intend Minnesota to be your permanent residency, then you're a resident, and you pay tax on all of your income from whatever source derived to Minnesota. In 1987, and that's, you know, the way most taxes have always worked, and there are, you know, myriad U.S. Supreme Court cases, state cases on exactly what does it take to determine whether you're domiciled in the state. In 1987, the legislature decided at the instigation of the governor at that time to enact a second test, the statutory residency test. That's the test that we're talking about here, and that's the day count test, that if you spend more than half of the days in Minnesota, you can then separately, under that test, become a resident. And if you look at the language in Representative Quam's bill on lines 1.18 through 1.20, you can see the language, the stricken language there that implemented that day count test. And the issue that was involved in the Marks case was what happens when somebody changes their residence in the middle of a tax year under the other test, the domicile test. So they've actually, you know, moved to Minnesota, and it's very clear that Minnesota is going to be their permanent home. How do you determine, how do you apply the statutory residency test in that year? And the statutory residency test, just to make it clear, you have to do two things. You have to be present in Minnesota more than half of the tax year, and you have to have an abode. That means you have to own a home or you have to rent a home. So then the issue comes when we count those days. If you read the language here, the natural reading of it sort of says that if you're not domiciled in Minnesota, so you don't meet that other test, then we're going to start counting your days. And so the natural question is, well, what happens in that year when you move into Minnesota and actually change your domicile? The natural reading of this language, and that's why the court and Marks had trouble, is to sort of say, this only applies to people who are not domiciled in Minnesota. But then you end up with the anomalous situation that Mr. Cummings was talking about, that in that, if you do that and you say, we're going to ignore those days when you were domiciled in Minnesota, you could have somebody who can spend 364 days here, be a part resident and not a full year resident, where you can have somebody who's a true non-domiciliary who spends only 190 days, let's say, in Minnesota, who would be a resident. Now, the department, when they put out administrative rules, immediately in the year after the 1987 legislative change, clarified and said, hey, in that circumstance, we're going to count every day. And that rule has been there since 88. But because of the language, a lot of tax practitioners looked at it and they didn't believe that. The reason why they didn't believe it is because if you just read the language, it says resident also means any individual domiciled outside the state. So, gee, we're not going to count those days because that's the natural way you read that language, contrary to the department's rule. What happened in Marks was that the court, first of all, in the tax court read the rule the way the tax practitioners did, not the way the department's rule was. You got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court looked at the language, and they thought about the tax policy, and they thought about, hey, the Marks case, they owned a Minnesota resident for the entire year. They moved back to Minnesota after the year was half over in August. But they had actually spent one or more of them, according to the facts in the case, 250 days in Minnesota. And I'm sure the court thought, from a tax policy perspective, does it make sense to have somebody who is a non-resident for the domicile test for the entire year, who spends maybe 188 days here and is a resident, pays tax on all their income to Minnesota. And then you have a case like the Marks, who are here 252 days or whatever, I think that was the number, and they can pay tax as a part-year resident and not pay tax. And that didn't make sense to them, and it raises the administrative problems that Mr. Cummings raised, that, gee, then you're going to have to really figure out exactly when people change their residence, because that's going to affect the day count, and it's going to change that. And so the court strained to read the language the way the department's administrative rule said it. But the dissent, as Representative Quam points out, said, gee, this doesn't make sense. That's not the way the language reads. And so we're going to read it the natural way the language reads. And so that's the position you're in. You can decide Representative Quam's bill would make the language even clearer to make it clear that the dissent view would prevail, or you could just leave it the way it is, which is the way the department's rule and the way everybody now understands it. So that's sort of the issue.
Thank you for clearing that up for us.
What did you just say?
Okay. Well, no, thank you, Mr. Mike. That was very good. We're going to name it Quam versus Cummings. So, okay, so with that, let's go to some questions. Anybody else wish to get in the middle of this one? We have a wise group with us today. Okay, so let's go to Representative Chair Carlson and then Representative McDonald. Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to draw members' attention to the revenue note. And I guess when we ask for revenue note on a bill like this, it's an impossible question to answer. You know, it says the general fund unknown. But then when you read down below the detail of the analysis, it said the bill would result in a revenue loss that could be significant. And I think we have to be alert to that, in a sense, knowing what road we'd be on. Just the case that we've been talking about is referenced in the revenue note, Marks versus Commissioner Revenue. And that case alone, there was $600,000 on the table. So I just want to draw members' attention to the revenue note. I know, as all bills, we would be laying this over, but I would counsel that we be cautious about what road we're on when we can't really get anything that would provide us with a good number as to what the impact would be.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Mr. Michael, when did you start working for the state of Minnesota? What year? I know you started very young.
1976.
Okay, 1976. This came in 87. Yeah. That'd be the Purpich administration. Do you recall the discussion at this table right here? during that time, I mean, it must have been kind of controversial at the time, or was it? Or did they just throw it in there and it was fine and good?
Mr. Chairman, I don't remember the specific discussion of this, or it was part of a massive restructuring of the income tax. And I will say, I did not draft this. This was drafted by the Department of Revenue.
Paul's fault.
Yeah.
A previous
resource. Yeah.
The previous resource person.
Remember that in 1986, the federal government totally restructured the federal income tax in the 1986 Tax Reform Act. And Minnesota had been making creeping efforts in that direction. And in 1987 decided to sort of go, you know, the whole Monty or the whole hog or however you want to decide, and essentially eliminate, you know, virtually all of the differences from federal law. We had many differences from federal law before that. I mean, when I started here, we actually didn't follow federal filing status rules and, you know, a variety of other things. But we got rid of, you know, a whole host of things, and the committee's focus, honestly, at that time was largely on those tax-based issues and not issues like this. These statutory residency rules have been a growing trend in most states. I think in New York or California may have been the first ones, and so it was a trend that most states were doing to try to provide some certainty to these people who spend a lot of time in the state. But may or may not meet the domicile test. For example, your bill that's in conference focuses on that domicile test. And the difficulty with the domicile test is the department has to look into the intention of the taxpayer and essentially read their mind. And the problem with that is then you're in this world of looking at, well, gee, where's your, you know, religious affiliation? What country clubs do you belong to? Where are you employed? You know, where do your kids go to school? All of those kinds of things that are problematic from a tax administration point of view. And so the trend with this day count was, well, it'll be simple. You know, we can just look and see, do you have an ATM or a credit card statement or airline tickets to verify? You may claim your residences, right, you know, in Kansas, but hey, you spent 189 days in Minnesota, so we're just going to treat you as a resident regardless of whatever you intended.
Mr. Michael, what in the Marks versus Commissioner Revenue, okay, so the courts determined that the Marks were residents of Minnesota. Were they also, what other state, what state were they from? What state did they think they were from?
Mr. Chairman, they were, their other home was in Florida, and they were not disputing that Minnesota was their residence. It was just, were they a resident for the entire year? They had changed their residence to Florida several years before and then had a change of mind and decided to move back to Minnesota.
Why would you do that?
They wanted to put their children in Minnesota schools.
Oh. Okay.
And so they moved back in August, and I think they also ran them in, I don't remember the facts of the case exactly, but I believe that Mr. Marks runs a Minnesota business or was involved in a Minnesota business.
I only say that because we're supposed to be getting 14 inches of snow today, and a couple weeks ago I was in Orlando just trying to work through this from a tax perspective.
Mr. Chairman, those of us in August aren't going to experience that snow, so you just chose the wrong place to live.
I guess I did. Okay, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question regarding the residency test. I was talking to some bakers from my district earlier this week, and I guess I could certainly look this up online, but since Mr. Cummings is in front of us, in part of the testing of the statutory testing, residency test, do you have to, is part of your banking institution, is that part of the residency test to whether or not you bank here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald, the what I don't have the rule in front of me in terms of what it is. I know that one of the things that we talked about in our revenue notice that we just released is talking about the bank accounts. So what we clarified in the revenue notice is having one or more bank accounts does not by itself demonstrate or establish or retain domicile. And then it also does talk about financial institutions within the rule right now. And, you know, I think some of that was where are those financial institutions? Like, where is that bank or whatever it is? Part of what we're doing now and what we've trained our professionals on is that we're really trying to look at where the transactions occur, where the what ATM is the money being pulled out on, where is the loan application completed physically, where is the account opened.
Representative McDonald?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Question for the author, then. Recently I read an article that stated, I think, since 2013 to the present date, that over $2 billion of revenue lost to the state of people moving out of state. I'm trying to find it on my phone. I saved it as a bookmark, but perhaps some of you have seen it. But anyway, the report did indicate with the Department of Revenue that it was a $2 billion loss to the state since 2013 to this day. Would your bill help bring that revenue back, or at least keep more revenue from leaving the state?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. The intent of the bill, not the specific language, the intent of the bill would, if the legislature steps up and more clearly defines residency and prevents misinterpretations or various interpretations which cause people pause to keeping funds in the state, having other interactions financially, and et cetera, within the state of Minnesota. And so the intent of the bill is not specifically the language to elicit a vibrant, active discussion and also illuminate the confusion on the subject so that the legislature would be prodded and prompted to clearly define, you know, step up and clear it up. Because even though the Department of Revenue is great, as in they're educated, well-trained, and they're great at creating rules on an interpretation of what the legislature has done, I want the legislature to make it easier for a unified interpretation so we don't have, you know, residents thinking, you know, I moved to Florida and I've got to pull all my money out of the local bank, or I got to stop working with the financial advisor because that adds a brick to making me a resident. So yes, if the intent of the bill comes through by making it clear and getting rid of misunderstandings, I would hope that the result would be fewer people doing less activity in Minnesota for fear of being interpreted as being a resident.
Representative McDonald?
Thank you. That's good. Thank you, Representative Quam. And then just lastly, Mr. Cummings, in your statement regarding the Marks versus the Commissioner of Revenue, you stated that a resident who is here part-time should be paying for the services that the state, and I would agree with that, but you stated that those who take advantage of or at least are paying for police and fire should be considered in that residency test. I guess I'm paraphrasing. Question is, though, that I think a property tax owner, if they have a property here, that property tax, local property tax, pays for fire and police protection. Wouldn't that be correct?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and members, there are a number of different things that are paid through Minnesota taxes on a on the state and local level. I know many times, we just heard yesterday, Mr. Chair, our local government partners were talking about the importance of local government aid that is funded through our income tax and our sales tax in order to ensure that they are able to reduce property taxes and provide an equal level of services across the state. And again, Mr. Chair, I'll just go back to not my words, but the words of the Supreme Court in talking about, you know, state laws protecting their checking accounts, savings account, investment accounts, as well as many of the corporations that she, that this person was affiliated with, benefited from the high health and environmental standards, educational opportunities, arts and cultural opportunities, recreational opportunities, etc. So I would agree, Representative McDonald, that there are some taxes that are more on a transactional basis, but there are others that help to create the kind of state that we all want to continue to have, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald? Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we seem to be up to our ears in lawyers here. And so I'm wondering, the Bar Association, estate planning folks, things like that, Representative Quam, have you been engaged with them in drafting the bill? Are they present in the audience? Do they wish to testify? Have they stated support, opposition, neutrality, confusion, anything regarding this legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, you know, frankly, this is a new experience for me in that this is meant to be a vehicle as opposed to, you know, starting out as, you know, pushing the language. The point about, you know, lawyers or law, you know, people being confused when you have, you know, a tax judge ruling, you know, overturned that, and you've got a minority report, I think by definition you have confusion from the legal community as to the you know, statute and its interpretation. I have spoken to people trying to get a feel for the source of that confusion and what the legislature could do to alleviate that. I have not had a lobbyist from the bar or that type of organization come forward to me. It's been more of seeking out conversations with different parties to understand how we could alleviate that by stepping up and clarifying as a legislature so the interpretations are not clouded.
I think, Chair Dabney, we have someone who would like to make a few comments. Oh. You still have the floor, sir, but I would like to just let Chair Carlson know that this was referred to as a vehicle bill. It's not one of my vehicle bills.
Because, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask if we just found the 2016 omnibus tax bill.
No, I have many other bills that are vehicle bills, not this one. At this point, now, we might need to be creative. Okay, Chair Dabney still has the floor. Then we'll go to Carlson. But if you please state your name and who you represent for the record and why in the world you'd want to get in the middle of this one.
Mr. Chair, Brian Lake, represent the State Bar Association. I don't want to get in the middle of this. but I can tell you that I did run the language of the bill past the tax law section of the bar. They think clarity would be good, and they're comfortable with the language in the bill.
Oh.
Thank you. Okay.
Chair Dabney.
After the crack about the vehicle bill, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments for our good friend Representative Quam? Okay, with that being said, I will renew my motion that House File 2972 be laid over for possible inclusion in something. Okay, in a bill. Chair Carlson.
I just wanted to go back to the vehicle bill, and I was going to suggest that you choose a bill with a number that everybody will remember for years to come.
Such as?
Well, on the floor the other day, they mentioned 1812 again.
Just so it's not 666. Do they skip that number? No, there's a 666. Or 13, maybe? Okay, thank you. I think. Okay, with that, let's go to Representative Freiberg. I will move House File 2387. Members, there is an amendment. Is that an author? Well, we'll let him get down here.
On the pay raise?
Thank Welcome you, to the committee, sir. Is that your amendment?
Yes. Amendment.
Okay, traditionally we put author's amendments on, so I'll move the H23871 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion barely passes. Okay, so with that, we have House File 2387 as amended. If you could please describe your bill, Representative. But excuse me, before we do that, I see there's a couple fine folks here at the table. Well, three of them. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Or Chair Anderson?
Oh, Mr. Chair, House File 666 was the commissioner pay raise issue from last year.
How appropriate.
Is what?
Your kid, is that right?
Pay raise from last year.
Ooh. What was 1812?
Pardon?
Chair Carl, what was House File 1812?
That was the supplemental appropriations bill about 6 years ago, and if you got time for just a short story.
Oh, sure.
Margaret Anderson Kelleher was Speaker, and so I was putting together the next supplemental appropriations bill 2 years later, and I was meeting with the Speaker, and she said, Lynn, have you selected a House File number yet? And I said, yes, I have, and it was 18-something or other. And she said, is there anything historically significant with that? And I said, yes, it was the year of the Great Panic under Grover Cleveland. And she kind of quietly said, Lynn, do you think you could select another vehicle, another number?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair.
That was the history in me, you know, just looking for fun numbers.
For this session, it's the medical cannabis removal.
Wow. Numbers do make a difference. Okay, so with that, welcome to the Tax Committee. We have House File 2387 as amended before us. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to visit about this bill?
I believe the two behind me.
Oh, my gosh. We got the whole crew here. Okay, yeah. So let's start with your bill, and then we'll go to testimony.
Sure. I'm sure the testifiers will keep it short in deference to the committee members' time, which I appreciate your time for hearing this bill. I've been in the legislature. I'm in my fourth year now, and it seems like something related to this issue has come up every year so far. In 2013, for the benefit of the members who weren't around then, I'm sorry, I'm getting over a cold too. The legislature exempted cities and counties, local governments, from paying sales tax. However, because of an interpretation of the Department of Revenue, the following year it was determined that joint powers organizations were not included in that definition of local government. So
the department's fault.
Somebody's fault, yes. So that's my understanding of how it happened. So let's just say we're all equal. We're all at fault. It's an issue that affects, you know, I mean, when you talk about sales tax exemptions for joint powers organizations, you know, people's eyes maybe tend to glaze over, maybe not as much as the discussion of your previous bill. It is an issue that affects every district. In my district, we have the West Metro Fire Rescue District comprised, which serves the cities of Crystal and New Hope, and I'm grateful that the chief is here to speak about this issue. Cities and counties are working together on more and more issues, so this is an issue a lot of local taxpayers can feel fairly acutely. So in 2014, I introduced a bill to extend the sales tax exemption to joint powers organizations. It wasn't just me. It's a bipartisan issue. I know Representative Pugh, Representative Zerwas also had bills doing essentially the same thing, and we were able to get that passed. But then... moved to last year, 2015, and for reasons I still don't entirely understand, as part of the education bill, there was a delay of the exemption for joint powers organizations. This bill would just undo that with the amendment that you passed. It puts basically the law back in the shape it was before that delay was put into effect last year. So that's really all I need to say. I know Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities was interested in saying a few words first.
So, Representative Freiberg, with your amendment, we go back retroactive January 1st, 2016, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Michael, or Ms. Dolan, can we do that? Oh, we're the taxman. We can do whatever we want. But is that okay with you?
Mr. Chair, careful. You may do whatever you want. yes, there is actually a refund mechanism in the bill that would essentially allow anybody who's already paid taxes in 2016 to file one return for any of the taxes they had paid.
Okay, so we have, who would like to go first? Mr. Carlson, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'll take the blame on the fact that the 2013 law did not clearly include joint powers or special districts. So don't blame the department on that. I just didn't think about it when I drafted the bill. So. Mr. Chair, members, again, I do represent the League of Minnesota Cities, but I'm also here today to express the support of the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Metro Cities Organization, and the MICA organization. My brother, Keith Carlson, wanted to make sure that he expressed his support. He's down in another committee hearing this morning, but we all have been working together. We support the idea of not disincenting joint powers entities. The change was made last year in the special session Chapter 3 bill. That was the K-12 education bill, and it was done. I was not aware of that change. It was, according to my friends in the education community, done fairly late at night, so I was not successful in getting that changed. But I do want to just stress that you have all encouraged us at the local level to be more efficient, to challenge us to provide services to Minnesota citizens more effectively. And with me today, I have a representative of one of our successful joint powers entities, Chief Sarah Larson, who would like to express her support for the bill as well.
Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Larson, and I am the fire chief of the West Metro Fire Rescue District, which serves the cities of Crystal and New Hope and was formed in 1998.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. The purpose of our joint powers is to provide effective yet fiscally responsible fire services to the city of Crystal and New Hope. Legislature has encouraged local entities to share services and work together in cost-saving measures, and we are an example of how that can be successful. Our per capita costs are much lower than many of our single cities in our area. Delaying the exemption is confusing and a hindrance to those cost-saving measures. An example of this would be, while purchasing an emergency vehicle, the equipment that we purchase with that is tax-exempt at that time of purchase. But to replace that equipment, many of its life-saving equipment, such as communications, radios, mobile data units, thermal imagers, we have to pay sales tax on that, while a department of a single city would not. It has also caused confusion in the fact that by distinguishing us as separate from cities, it even puts into question whether we could buy the emergency vehicle tax exempt. I testified in 2014 for the legislation that enacted to exempt local government instrumentalities from paying sales tax on most purchases. I am here today in hopes to restore the law enacted in 2014, and I appreciate the legislative seeing the value in this exemption. Thank you.
Thank you. And weren't you a St. Louis Park Oriole?
I was.
Well, once an Oriole, always an Oriole.
Always an Oriole.
That's what I say. Okay, any questions for the two folks, one of the brothers Carlson or Chief Larson, Chair Carlson?
Yeah, there's another Carlson in the room that's not one of the brothers, I guess. But I have a question of Mr. Carlson. My recollection of this issue was that when you drafted the bill, you said local units of government. And then we had an interpretation by revenue that did not include the joint powers. Personally, my reading of local units of government would have included the joint powers. I view them as a local unit of government. But when we talk about where responsibility lies, I think, rightly or wrongly, that was a Department of Revenue interpretation, if I recall, of how they defined local units.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I thought we had the bill drafted appropriately and, can always second-guess the language and the definitions you put in the bill. So I just don't want to blame the department entirely because I probably should have caught the definitional issue when it was done. I mean, we do have some joint powers entities that do include, in Minnesota, that do include non-governmental units. so that those may have been part of the issue as well, that they're not exclusively a formation of entirely local units of government. So in retrospect, I would have worked on a different bill draft with my brother, but we unfortunately did not quite catch this, so I'll just take responsibility for it.
I think it's the department's fault.
Mr. Chairman, I did say rightly or wrongly, I wasn't necessarily trying to find fault at this point, other than to say that one of the reasons that the issue is before us was a department interpretation of what local unit of government meant. And I was just sharing my view of the words local unit of government would have been broader than what the department happened to interpret it as. But be that as it may, I think Mr. Cummings is coming forward, being that we referenced the department.
Before we go to Mr. Cummings, are there any other questions for Mr. Carlson, G, or Chief Larson? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know who the question's for. I'm just curious. I've heard from the Soil and Water Districts, and they suggested they were not covered by the exemption. Is that in the January 1, 2017 and beyond current language in law? Is that right, Ms. Dalton?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, actually that question was also sent to me a couple of days ago. As far as I can tell, these people are covered. They are part of the special, they may not be a special taxing district, but they are certainly meet the definition of a special district in section, I've got to look it up. In section 6.465, which basically, I took a look at it. I believe they are all covered.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. It sounds like maybe they're not clear. Maybe Mr. Chair or Mr. Cummings or somebody could send them a letter and we'd be good.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski. Mr. Carlson, G.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I think what might have happened is that the delay has delayed the effective date for their exemption, like it did for the joint powers and other special districts. So I think that might be the confusion. I think that if the law were to have gone into place last year without the special session change in the effective date, that they would now be exempt, I believe. So I think that's what's going on here, is that the delay has delayed their exemption, but they were captured by Representative Freiberg, Representative Pugh, Representative Zerwas's change in 2014.
Ms. Dalton?
I was going to say, they either I wanted to clarify my earlier statement. They either meet the definition of a special district, or they are an instrumentality of either a county, city, or town, or a joint powers board, and the instrumentalities are also covered here.
So what you're saying is they're either covered or they're not.
They're, Mr. Chair, I'm saying...
Well, they're covered or they're covered.
They're covered or they're covered. Depending on how they are organized, they're either an instrumentality of one of the local governments, and the instrumentalities are covered beginning January 1 of this year under this bill, or they are a special district under 6.465.
Kind of like Allstate, you're covered.
Mr. Chair, they're double covered.
Chair Drazkowski.
They're double covered.
Double covered, just like being a citizen of two states. They're a resident, right? Yeah. Where's this going? Are we okay for Chief Larson and Mr. Carlson G? Okay, you may be excused. The department? Thank you, Chief Larson. Go Orioles. I've always said that, and unless I'm in Baltimore. Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, if you could give us a little clarity.
Mr. Chair.
We could use some right now.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I just wanted to first state that this bill is administrable, and I was not planning on being a resource today. I think in terms of July 1st, that would be a date in which this would be easily administrable as an upfront exemption. As Ms. Dalton stated, there would be some refund elements that we have looked at and we would find administrable. I did want to also just clarify that either in the 2011 session or 2012 session, there was an extension of the sales tax exemption to townships. This was to provide some extra relief there. When the exemption was extended to cities and counties, cities and counties were added to the definition. So the interpretation of local units of government was done by the legislature and not by the Department of Revenue. We did whatever we could, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, to ensure that if there was a way that they were reporting through a city or through a county, we were trying to find ways to help local units of government to get through that.
So, Mr. Cummings,
and I think that we have been a good partner, Mr. Chair, in trying to make sure that the legislation is administrable moving forward.
So, Mr. Cummings, you're saying it's former Chair Lencheski's fault?
No, Mr. Chair, I am.
You are a wise man. A wise man. Okay, so with Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's true. They did try to. I had some conversations with House Research and with the department on that issue way back when, and they did try to be helpful. That should be very clear.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, the next testifier, we have a Jill Rohert. Did I say that right? How do you say it?
Mr. Chair, Jill Rohert. I'm with the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board.
Welcome to the committee, and we also have Jason McCrew King.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Who would like to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Jason McGrew King. I am the Intergovernmental Relations and Communications Supervisor with Three Rivers Park District. And I'm here today to express Three Rivers Park District's support for this bill, which would provide the same sales tax exemption to the Park District in 2016 that other units of local government, including cities, counties, and townships, are currently receiving. Three Rivers is a special park district and a political subdivision organized pursuant to Minnesota Statutes Chapter 398. It manages almost 27,000 acres of park reserves, regional parks, regional trails, and special use facilities in the Twin Cities metro area, and it's the only special park district in the state of Minnesota. Park District provides recreation and outdoor education services to nearly 11 million visitors every year and restores and protects natural resources within the Twin Cities metro area. And each year, the Park District pays approximately $500,000 in sales tax. Like other political subdivisions that currently benefit from the sales tax exemption, the Park District provides public services to the communities we serve. The services are supported by a property tax levy in suburban Hennepin County. And going forward, the sales tax exemption will reduce the property tax impact for taxpayers of suburban Hennepin County. And this bill would allow the Park District to begin realizing savings in the budget beginning in 2016. And I just want to thank you for your leadership on this issue and Representative Freiberg for introducing the bill. And with that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McGrew-King. Jay, let's get some more testimony here from Ms. Rohert. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jill Rohert. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board here in St. Paul.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Metropolitan Emergency Services Board is a joint powers board of the nine metropolitan counties in the city of Minneapolis. We are the 911 authority here in the metro region. We also serve as the regional radio board for the armor system for the metro region and provide regional EMS programming. So we are one of seven statewide regional and emergency communications boards across the state. Of those seven boards, we are actually very fortunate in that there is already a sales tax exemption for the armor radio system. So if we make a purchase on behalf of the region related to that radio system, that is sales tax exempt. However, we are not as fortunate if we make such a purchase on the 911 system. And we are in the process of making many purchases as we are updating the technology for the 911 system. So this is the sales tax exemption that if it were to be enacted here in 2016, we could realize substantial savings. We'd just like to note that, you know, all of our members, because we are made up of local governments, we do assess them, and that is how we are funded. And so because we are still paying the sales tax on two-thirds of our areas, those local jurisdictions are, in essence, still paying sales tax because we have to include that amount in our budgets. That's all.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Rohert or Mr. McGrew-King? Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, thank you very much to the testifiers. Thank you very much, Mr. Freiberg. So I'll move House File 2387 as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in a possible omnibus tax bill, too, if there is one. Okay, so with that, anything else for the good of the order? I would just say for tomorrow, we're having a presentation of wealth migration, and we're going to have kind of both sides of the issue testified. I kind of feel like Fox News, fair and balanced here. And so with that, members, and I'd like to thank Mr. Michael for his presentation regarding the QAM bill. So with that, if there's nothing else for the good of the order, good government all the time, we are adjourned.